Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It is our 2023 first base preview episode. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. We're going to go through taking a look at early ADP, looking at this position, breaking it down from almost every angle with the hope of making you better prepared for your fantasy baseball drafts. And Eno, this is a funny position because I think compared to some of the other infield spots, it's got enough depth where you can play it a lot of ways. It's not as top heavy as the other corner, which will be our next position preview. And it certainly doesn't tail off anything like second base does. I think when we get to the second base preview, people are going to be just stunned at how that depth seems to evaporate as quickly as ever. But there's some bigger changes around the game that might have something to do with that. But we begin in the first round. We have a couple of first rounders by ADP in Vlad Jr. and Freddie Freeman. If we're talking about a 15-team league, Freddie sometimes slips into the early part of round two. And I decided to expand this tier. Instead of just saying the first rounders are the only ones in tier one, I included the consistent second rounders here as well. So we are looking at Paul Goldschmidt and Pete Alonso as we get started today as well. But let's start with Vlad Jr. A little bit of a slide from where he was going this time last year. Understandably, a slight step down in production in 2022. But in some ways, I think it's possible we still haven't seen the absolute best season from Vlad Jr., or at least I don't think it's impossible that he could come close to what he did in 2021 again. I still think that's in his reasonable range of outcomes within a handful of home runs. 48 home runs, yeah, with the deadened ball, that might be more difficult. But relative to the field, I think he could still be someone that leads all of Major League Baseball in home runs, and he could do it with a great average and very good run production as well.
Yeah, he just, that old kind of, hitting the ball on the ground thing came back. There's also an interesting article out right now on Sportsnet that the walls are changing in Toronto. When we look back on that 48 home run season in 2021 for Vladito, I feel like we may remember Buffalo, we may remember Dunedin, and how he did not quite have the same home run pace in the second half after they were starting to play in Toronto. So in 2022, he played in Toronto and he had 32 homers and 8 stolen bases and returned by the auction calculator the 23rd best hitter last season. But now the walls are changing again. And it's really hard when you read that article, it's really hard to tell which way that place is going to go, because there are places where the wall is going up, places where the wall is going down, places where the wall is coming in, and places where, I don't think there's places where the wall is going out, but there's places where the walls are going up. So it's going to get harder in some places, easier in other places. I wonder if they looked at, spray charts for their hitters and are like, oh, they'll do down hip here and up over here where they don't hit the ball. like if they've like figured it all out for their hitters, or if it's, it does seem actually sort of driven by marketing. So it's designed to create some extra spaces. The trend in baseball now is to create sort of party spaces where not everyone's sitting down. So there's like this idea that not everyone's necessarily there to watch every single pitch. So you create these spaces where people can drink and party and watch on the TV and have more access to the bar and that sort of stuff. So they're going to lose like 1,000 or 2,000 seats capacity and create these extra spaces that are interesting. So I don't know exactly what that's going to do. And then you have, for Guerrero himself, you have this kind of yo-yoing ground ball rate, 49.6 in his rookie season, 54.6 in 2020, 44.8 last year, and 44.8 in 2021, 52.1 last year for Vladito. So what's his ground ball rate going to be? I love the plate discipline. I love the contact ability. I love the power. And the age is the one thing that's also pointing to him to maybe be as valuable as Freddie Freeman next year. As much as I think Freddie Freeman is falling off on the power front, he stole 13 bases. The auction calculator said he was the third best player in baseball last year in fantasy baseball. Kind of hard to bet against a guy like that who's showing speed still. You know, it's like, yeah, he hits too many opposite field fly balls. Yeah, the power's coming down. Psh, still 300 hitter, 20 homers, 10 stolen bases, like with tons of runs in RBI.
Yeah, I think for Vlad Jr., right now he's the third highest projected hitter when you run a 15-team, you know, 5x5 league through the Fangraphs auction calculator with the BatX. So only Judge and Acuna have a better dollar value projection than Vlad. I'm fine with Vlad.
Vlad is projected by the BatX over Freddie Freeman.
Yeah, he's projected ahead of Freeman. I think because of age, it's almost a 10-year age difference between them. That's another thing that would lead me to be on the Vlad side of this one. But with Freddie Freeman, we talked about this in season, the strange reduction in home runs in the face of a guy that still has red ink up and down the Statcast page. He still hits the ball very hard. He still barrels the ball enough. He doesn't strike out a lot. He still draws a lot of walks. He doesn't chase that much. Everything you need Freddie Freeman to do to still be an excellent hitter is still in place. And when everything didn't come out quite as good as you would have expected from the power perspective, he found a way to make up for it. And of course, being in that lineup, the counting stats were absurd. 117 runs, 100 RBIs. I mean, he maxes out playing time.
Will some of that come back?
I think some of that has to come down, right? Because we were talking about this on an episode recently, looking at this Dodgers infield, and they could make a trade. That's still possible. They're probably not, as a team, going to score as many runs as they did in 2022. So that is going to hurt someone like Freeman in those categories. But we're talking about slight drops. They're not going to crash and become some sort of league average or fringe top 10 lineup, I don't think. I think they're still going to be a very good offense, even if they're not elite anymore.
The rule changes will affect Freddie Freeman in two different ways that may not affect Vlad Guerrero Jr. that much. First of all, Freddie Freeman is in that sort of okay but not great speed category where, you know, he had 13 steals and he's, you know, he's decently fast at first base. He may steal more bases next year just because of, you know, because of the rules. And then lastly, Freddie Freeman hits the ball hard between 0 and 10 degrees launch angle to the pull side. And I think that's going to be crucial for determining who will benefit from the shift rules the most. Left-handers who pull the ball at 0 to 10 degrees and pull it hard. So I did a query that was like, how many pulled line drives, over 90 miles an hour, 0 to 10 degrees, did these guys have? And I just did raw numbers because why not? You know, just get a sense of the volume of hits that might be changed next year. And Freddie Freeman leads all first basemen in 28 of those hits. So he hits the ball there. He hits the ball where they shift. And, you know, they're going to have to make some decisions. Freddie Freeman has showed up in almost every one of the places that I've tried to look at who will benefit from this. So take your pick, I guess. They go pretty close to each other. I think you can go with your gut. I mean, they're both projected really high. You know, Freddie Freeman in the bat is like $32. Guerrero is 36. I think that's sort of in the margin error, you know.
I think one thing you could also consider is if you are in a position in the back of round one, there's at least a chance Freeman is still there with your early second round pick. I don't think Vlad Jr. is as likely to fall, so you could get something else. You could get an outfielder, you could get the first starting pitcher off the board, whatever it is that you want to take in that first round spot, and then still have the possibility of getting Freeman, and you end up with the best combo of players. I mean, that's a big part of the strategy here as well. The other two guys in this group who more frequently, almost always, are in the second round are Paul Goldschmidt and Pete Alonso. With Goldschmidt, the season he just had last year, you're talking about how valuable Freddie Freeman was. Goldschmidt was almost a $48 player, looking at the RotoWire earn values for 15-team leagues from last year. If you look back at the two-year combined totals, more homers than Freeman, only two fewer steals, very similar run production, albeit a little more balanced between runs and RBIs from Goldie, whereas over the last two seasons combined, Freeman has a little extra in runs and a little less in RBIs, but that could be pretty variable depending on a lot of other factors. Nevertheless, it seems like there's still just a little bit of skepticism about Goldschmidt relative to Freeman, and they're two guys that have played at a very high level for a long time. So what do you make of the Goldie skepticism? Is it just being a little bit older?
Yeah, and it's always worth being skeptical of someone in their early 30s. You know, he's even in his mid-30s. At 35, you know, the drop-off can come at any time. At the same time, he has a much more balanced skill set and hasn't really shown that much in terms of falling off. I'm a little surprised that Goldschmidt goes after Alonso.
Yeah.
Because as much as I like Alonso, he's much more of a one-note guy. And taking a one-note guy in the second round, as you would with Pete Alonso, is not keeping you afloat in the steals category. You know, Goldschmidt is going to out-batting average him. Although, Alonso has made some real strides in the K department. And, you know, there is always the chance that he gets a little lucky and does hit like, you know, 280 in a season. But most likely you're standing pat in batting average. You're taking a big jump forward in power, but you are losing ground in stolen bases if you take Alonso. I mean, this, you know, in the second round, I'm still trying to, you know, add in all categories.
We've previously talked about how the back part of round two, so once you get past like pick 20, pick 22, 23, it falls off a little more, or it's at least filled with players that are a little different for that range. It's either guys that came up and produced at a high level for the first time last season. There's a catcher in that mix in JT Realmuto that plays a ton, does everything, and also just had a very long season. So you wonder if that workload could actually have some, you know, negative impact on his 2013 or 2023. But the thinking here is I trust all of these top tier first basemen. I don't see warts with any of them. They're all good. They're Goldschmidt and Alonso. Even if you're a little skeptical of Goldschmidt, he'd be in that group of second rounders I like, second rounders I trust. Or if I'm in the middle of the round, I'm happy if he's the best hitter still available, because the odds of him falling completely on his face seem very, very low. And I think you pointed out Alonso's improved K rate. He's got that under 20% now over the last two seasons combined. That's not necessarily something I expected to see back when he broke into the league. So I do think his floor has crept up. He's become even less of a batting average liability over time with that improved strikeout rate.
Yeah, and he's not a pull everything guy. He's, you know, he was hitting oppo homers to win that home run derby. So he has power to all fields. He's a really good player. And I'm not really, there's nothing wrong about him from a real life standpoint. It's just that he doesn't steal bases. I think that, you know, I have talked about how I want to pick higher than 24th in the second round. You know, if people want to set their draft position, if they're allowed to in their leagues, I would do that. If I did get stuck with a draft position where I'm drafting between 25 and 30 in the second round, I do think I had said that Realmuto, Strider, and Lindor were interesting to me, but I think that despite no matter what the ADP says, I think Goldschmidt would have been the actual best pick, especially in my league where I took Tucker in the first round, pairing Tucker and Goldschmidt. I feel like I'm coming out of the first two rounds with a 300, near 300 batting average, because Tucker's going to be impacted by these new rules. Power and speed, I might come out of that first two rounds with 60-60, you know, or 60-50. And in homers and stolen bases. So I think Goldschmidt is a good pick if you are stuck, if you are sort of a 1-5 pick guy and you don't want to take Spencer Strider, you know, in that area. Like if you have the first pick, you know, it'd be really interesting. What if you paired Turner and Goldschmidt? You could still get a pitcher in the third.
Yes, I think you'll find that there's still plenty of high-quality starters going because starters, relative to the last few draft seasons, are sliding just a little bit in the early rounds. Before we go to Tier 2, maybe Matt Olson's in it. Maybe not. Maybe he's part of this group based on ADP. His ADP is right around that pick 40 range. Dollars earned, he kind of splits the difference between Goldschmidt and Alonso in that 25 to 29 range, and then the next group, which is a lot of high teens sort of players. Olson checks in just under $22, depending on the settings and projection system you're using. When you look at him side by side, though, with Pete Alonso,
yes,
the Bat X has Alonso giving up about 9 points in batting average. Everything else is almost the same. Handful of RBIs.
You mean Olson giving up about 9 points?
Yeah. Olson is almost Pete Alonso in the projections, which makes me think he belongs more at the back of this first group than at the top of the next group, because it's like a 40 to 50 pick drop before you get to the next cluster of first basemen.
Yeah, he's literally why I wouldn't want to necessarily take Alonso in the second, because I feel like Olson is there, you know, in the end of the third, maybe even drops to the fourth in some drafts. So I do struggle to find where the tier line is, because, you know, by dollar signs, the Bat X projects Olson to be $23, Alonso to be $26, the way I ran it. And then Hoskins is down at 17 with Abreu. So that's a natural tier where you say, okay, Olson is in that tier, right? However, projections are not the only thing. And when I look at this and see Rhys Hoskins at 17, along with Jose Abreu, Christian Walker, Ryan Mountcastle, in the 15 and up territory. So that might be your next tier, sort of 15 to 20, right? I want to take Hoskins out of that tier above it. I've talked about this with you, and I recently did a draft. I am in the middle of a draft. It's hard for me to get time right because we are recording a lot of these to bank them for reasons you will figure out later. So in this draft that I had in early January, I took Hoskins in the ninth round in order to avoid dropping out of that tier. Abreu had already gone. Nate Lowe had already gone. Vinny Pascantino had already gone. And I wanted to stay out of having to take Christian Walker or CJ Krohn. And, you know, with this group, you could say, well, they're all decent. Well, Abreu really started to not hit the fastball well. Last year was his worst year hitting the fastball. And, you know, it's hard to tell how important that is. There is an interesting piece by Robert Orr at Baseball Prospectus, and he's talking about Joey Meneses versus Schwindel. What's his first name?
Frank Schwindel.
Frank the Tank. And so he actually looked at Frank Schwindel against Joey Meneses, which is something we did in this podcast, as being like, oh God, hopefully not. For Joey Meneses. And one thing that he found was Joey Meneses actually, the same thing we found, which is that Joey Meneses hit the ball a lot harder than Frank Schwindel. So that's A. But B, also, that he hit the fastball a lot harder than Frank Schwindel. And that hitting the fastball hard predicts your future exit velocities better than hitting other pitches hard. So that's something you can kind of bank and just be like, okay, he hits the fastball hard. That's good. That means he still has his bat speed. Right? That seems like a good kind of proxy for bat speed. I like that. However, average exit velo is not that predictive for other stats. It's not that important among the suite of stats. So having something, knowing that average fastball velocity, exit velocity predicts exit velocity really well, that's nice, but exit velocities don't predict success that well. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Jose Abreu, despite the fact that he wasn't hitting the fastball that well, still, you know, made contact, still had a good barrel rate, had the same swing strike rate basically as Rhys Hoskins, You know, not quite the same barrel rates, better max EV than Rhys Hoskins. So there's, you know, you could, and a better ADP because he's got this long track record of having good batting averages. Maybe Jose Abreu is good, but I have questions about Jose Abreu. I have questions about Christian Walker because he lives up there in the 50% fly ball rate. I have questions about Ryan Mountcastle because he swings at everything. So Rhys Hoskins, you know, there he does have that high fly ball rate. There is some risk when it comes to his batting average, but he's in a great park for most of the year. He'll have a great lineup around him. I have, I think, fewer questions about him than I do about the rest of the guys in the tier that is sort of 15 to 20 that comes after Matt Olson. So I would be, I'd love to get Matt Olson and stay out of that question, you know, full stop. But I think in this group, Hoskins, Abreu, Walker, Mountcastle, I want Hoskins.
Yeah, I think you can do okay in this group if draft position or the dollars just don't quite work out when you're looking at these top five first basemen. I do think Olson, relative to Alonso, is a good value. Relative to the guys behind him, is a bit safer. I think the other guy that fits into this tier two cluster is Vinny Pasquantino, because you've got, you know, Nate Lowe. I think the way he did it last year looks pretty sustainable and legit. I don't really have any issue with where he's going, right around that pick 100 mark. Abreu's in that range,
except that he
too
doesn't pull the ball, so he's not gonna benefit from these rules. For example, Freddie Freeman had 28 pulled line drives in that band that I talked about. Nate Lowe had 15, and that's a big difference.
Yeah, I think for me, it's like he hit the ball in the air a little bit more last year. That's a change for the better.
He's a little bit more aggressive in general.
Keeps the K rate down at a reasonable low, like 22% range. Maybe ticks back up to 25, but that's something you can live with.
He's a decent player. I'm not sure how much is left to unlock. I know Donnie Ecker works there, and I respect the hell out of him. But you know, I don't know that there's much more past. Do you think he's going to hit 327 homers again?
No, I think the problem I think I would have with Lowe at this price isn't that I think he's going to fall apart or that he's not going to do something really close with the projections say. It's that when I look at the 260 to 270 average from the projection systems and low to mid-20s home run power without speed, I think you can find a few first basemen who go 50 picks later that have a good
Rowdy
enough chance of doing that. Yeah, that you don't necessarily need to take that skill set in that spot.
Yeah, but Pasquantino has like the same skill set.
Well,
the only
yeah
thing is higher upside, perhaps. Maybe. See, the thing is, what do we want out of Pasquantino? That he might hit 327 homers next year.
Right.
Lowe just did it.
Lowe just did it. Do you want the guy that just showed you he could do it, whose lineup keeps getting better or should keep getting better? Or do you want the guy that's still trying to do it for the first time at the big league level over
know
a full season?
Low is 101 and Vinny is 93. Like, why? It doesn't make sense to me, actually. As much as I don't love Nate Lowe's line, like, Lowe did it. The best thing that Vinny Pasquantino could do this year is what Nate Lowe did last year. That's how I feel.
There might be a ceiling above that, but I just think if you're expecting a ceiling above that, you are setting the bar in a place that is almost certainly going to disappoint you.
Yeah, I won't have much of any Pasquantino this year. As much as I like him, I really like him, but you know, I think the expectations are unreasonable. And there's a fairly large swath here between the bat and steamer when it comes to projections. He's got a 270 16 homer projection from the bat X and a 278 24 homer projection from the steamer. That's a pretty big gap there in terms of how much power is to be expected. In my draft that, you know, that I've had, Pasquantino went in the seventh round. Nate Lowe went later in the seventh round. And Rhys Hoskins went in the ninth. Jose Abreu went in the sixth. I continue to think that Rhys Hoskins is a value pick.
I think part of what makes guys pop on my sheet as I look at overall projections and performance is when I see projected WOBAs. I see a cluster of players who look kind of similar, and then I see one guy that has a WOBA that's like 10 points better than the group, and in this instance, that is Rhys Hoskins. You're giving up a little bit of batting average, but you're getting a higher power floor. Yeah. I'd rather have the power floor. I think the power is more predictable and more stable in this case. So I'm with you on Hoskins. I think he'll creep up a little bit. I also wonder if the timing of when projection systems come out, if that has a pretty strong influence on the early ADP. If Steamer is the only system that's out and Steamer is more bullish on young players like Vinny Pasquantino, they're going to probably carry ADPs that are a little higher than they should and become...
Isn't it bearish? Which one's bad?
Bearish would be means you...
Bear is bad.
You want to stay away. Bullish means that you'd be in, right?
So the bad X is bearish on young guys.
Right, and Steamer is bullish. And because Steamer is more bullish, then the market is more bullish.
Oh, so people are buying Vinny Pasquantino.
So there's a little bit of extra price on Pasquantino because of the order of the projection systems coming out. And again, there are things to like about him. You have to choose someone. That's the problem with snake drafts. You have to make a choice. I think it makes more sense to wait within this group or to go to a different position entirely in this range because there's so little that separates first baseman 6 from first baseman 16 or 17 right now. So I think this, you could argue that tier 2 is really deep, that it starts somewhere around Pasquantino and Lowe at pick 90, and it could run as far down as like pick 160 or 170, where you start to see Rowdy Tellez and Mountcastle and Anthony Rizzo.
Why am I going to take CJ Cron higher? You know, why am I going to take Ryan Mountcastle and Christian Walker where they're going when I like Rowdy Tellez? I like Anthony Rizzo. Mm-hmm. Anthony Rizzo is going, what, 150?
Yeah, right in that range.
I like Rizzo. Yeah, 150. I like Rizzo down there for sure. I mean, he's a lefty that did pull a lot of balls, 23 pulled balls. Him and Josh Naylor, 26 pulled balls in that area. Naylor didn't have quite the barrel rate of Rizzo, but he makes more contact. But Rizzo also has that short porch he's just aiming for, you know, and it's a really good mix of player and park. So I have Rizzo circled as a late guy. I have Rowdy circled as a late guy. I have Olson and Hoskins circled as one of the few that early guys that I'll take. And then I'm going to take a long break and see who's there later with between Tellez, Rizzo, and Naylor.
So I think there's a couple things that can go wrong once you enter this range, usually at the back of this range. You can start to run into players who lose playing time in the right situation. And I don't think Andrew Vaughn is one of those players. I think it's like either the guys that haven't proven it over a full season yet with the power, that'd be more like Vaughn, or it's guys that could slide into a slightly smaller role because the team added someone they can platoon with, or you know, there's just other factors in play that can really chip away at playing time.
I think that happens a little bit after like Rizzo, Naylor, Bell. I think it starts to happen around Vaughn. I mean, when I hear you say that, I hear Trey Mancini.
Yep.
A little bit, you know, Luis Arraez a little bit. Miguel Vargas has a nice projection. And I love him, and he hit fastballs really hard in his limited sample last year. But Miguel Vargas, we don't know where he sits on the depth chart. Jose Miranda, do we know where he sits on the depth chart and what his playing time will look like? So I think there's definitely another tier that ends around Andrew Vaughn and Ty France, and you get a little bit more. It gets a little bit more dicey after that. So yeah, I think you want, you know, two top 20 first basemen in most leagues.
I got pretty twisted up in this range in a slow draft I was doing where I didn't have a first baseman. And because I waited, I got down to the options of Bell, France, Rowdy Tellez. I think Naylor and Mountcastle were still out there. Maybe Rizzo was still there too. But this group of 6 was there. And I thought, I just don't want to miss on playing time in a draft and hold, especially because I can't go out and pick up someone else. So who do I think is most important to their team and who do I think is the most durable of this group? And I actually landed on Bell in France. And the more I've thought about it, the more I think I was actually underrating a guy that I watch all the time in Rowdy Tellez, because when you look at projections for Ty France, he's sort of the opposite of what I was talking about earlier with Hoskins. He has that projected WOBA 322 that actually seems pretty low for this group. And that's real life value. And that's a team in Seattle that's trying to continue to get better. They're trying to go back to the postseason. They might be more inclined to make a tough decision in the lineup in 2023 and take away some playing time if they have to. But he's a good defender at first base.
But also Ty France is like, if you just don't look at the projections and you kind of just look at their lineup and close your eyes, he's one of their only few hitters. You know, like, is it really going to get, if it gets bad, worse than Ty France, like if Ty France isn't good, then this lineup is not good. You know what I mean?
5.4%
barrel rate last year. Julio Rodriguez and Teoscar, who's going to be good if not Ty France? Like, he's their third best hitter.
I don't think that's a reason to take him over some of the other guys in this range.
Right. I'm just saying he may not lose time. Yeah, it's more of an alarm for the Mariners that they should have done a little bit more to improve this offense, I believe. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Ty France's barrel rate last year was below average for his position. I think it might be one of the worst barrel rates on here. I mean, Luis Urias, of course.
That's low for the league as a whole, too. I mean, 5.4%, that's just low.
It is the lowest at first base, other than Yuli Gurriel and Luis Urias, who are just different kinds of players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or if Yandy Diaz qualifies, he's under 20 games, so doesn't qualify in NFBC, he'd also be in that low range, too. But going back to Vaughn for a minute, I think I see the growth potential. I like a lot of things he does. He does not walk a lot, which is also something that's true of Ty France. I think that hurts his real-life value. But when I look at the White Sox depth chart, I think he's increasingly important to this lineup. I think the departure of like Jose France, Abreu.
They need him.
Yeah, they need to play him. So it's a question of whether or not you believe there's another level of power that he's going to unlock now that he's kind of back to his natural position and he can just focus a little more on taking the next step at the plate.
Vaughn has a little bit of a double whammy going on with the plate discipline that I don't like. I've talked a lot about O-swing on here and chase rate and how much I value players that don't chase. But when I did some research and found out that, you know, it's a little bit more powerful if you include how much they swing at strikes, because there are people who are too passive that don't swing at balls, but also just don't swing at strikes. There were times when Juan Soto last year was too passive. You know, he needed to get more aggressive in the strike zone to get back on track. Andrew Vaughn doesn't swing at strikes and does swing at balls. It's a bad combo. You know, 30% Z minus O is like, you know, zone swing minus O swing is bad. And he's under 30%. So I don't really know what's going on with that, because I don't think I got that impression of him as a hitter in college. I thought he had a decent sense of the zone. But this year, you know, in the major leagues, this has been a problem for him. And it's not something that's necessarily a one-year blip. He didn't swing at strikes his freshman year. And he did have a little bit of a tendency to swing at balls. So I tend to cast aspersions on White Sox coaching and player development, and it's particular when it comes to plate discipline. And I'm really interested by their hiring recently of Sam Mondry Cohen, who is a former AGM for the Nationals, who was the director of R&D for the Nationals, who's now going to be a traveling analyst with the White Sox. One thing I can say for Sam, there is a reputation in the Nationals front office that Mike Rizzo doesn't always listen to the nerds, quote unquote. That's the same reputation I have ever in Chicago. So he will be at home. Maybe he'll be able to get through. Maybe he understands what that's like, and maybe he'll be able to affect some of their coaching and some of their game day prep. And some of their player development in this new role. I'm fascinated by that hire in particular. And I'm fascinated by Andrew Vaughn because he has a great hit tool. He hits the ball the other way. He hits with power. He hits the ball hard. But he does things that I don't like. He goes the other way too much. He swings at too many balls and he doesn't swing at strikes. It's a very strange package for me. I don't want to say I don't like him overall, but he does things I don't like.
No, and I think that's where, is he overpriced? It doesn't mean he's bad. It just means you probably shouldn't take him where people tend to take him. If he's going to go at pick 130, it's probably a little bit early. You should probably take Christian Walker if that's the toss-up instead, because the power just looks so much more stable with the underlying metrics. There's a lineup that's also getting better, too. the Walker projection looks identical to the CJ Cron projection. I think with Cron, he has to deal with going in and out of Colorado, could get traded out of that situation and lose those home games. The long-term health of his knee has always been something that I've had kind of in the back of my mind. So for that reason, I'm Walker over Cron.
Are you looking at Christian Walker's page right now? If not, don't.
Okay. I'm not looking at it right now.
What was his batting average last year?
240.
Damn you. I thought it was like 215.
No.
Which it was for much of the year, right?
Yeah, but I think we talked about him at least once, probably two or three times. 204
in the first half, 285 in the second.
He was hitting the crap out of the ball all year.
Yeah. He just hit too many fly balls early, and look at that. He was at 51% fly balls when I talked to him about hitting too many fly balls, and he ended the year at 44%. That's amazing.
You helped him.
Well, he's really smart. He's really smart. Maybe I'm wrong about him. Maybe he belongs with Hoskins there. All right, I'll go Hoskins, Walker, Abreu, Mountcastle, Tellez. I'm denigrating Cron.
Okay, you're a little higher on Mountcastle than I might be.
That's a good projection.
Yeah. It's a very solid projection. I've always been skeptical. I've always had this little bit of doubt about Ryan Mountcastle.
He's very aggressive overall. Here's one of those ones where maybe our focus on chase rate missed the fact that he swings at 82% of the balls he sees in the strike zone. For example, for Ryan Mountcastle, 82% of the balls in the strike zone, 41 out. So that's a 41% difference. Andrew Vaughn, 63% in the strike zone, 35% out. Very different. 36% out. Yeah. So anyway, I think that Mountcastle is just a guy with a decent hit tool who's very aggressive.
The power's real. The power is backed up by barrel rates. 15% barrel rate last year. Power went down in large part because the park changed in Baltimore. So he could get a few homers back this year. I think that's reasonable just based on how hard he hits the ball. I think my concerns with Ryan Mountcastle are so rooted in real life value in that in 2021, even when he had 33 homers, it was a 111 WRC plus. Last year, it was a 106 WRC plus. This is an Orioles team that's getting better that will eventually have more threats to his playing time. I don't think this is the year it happens, but if you're in a keeper league or a dynasty league especially, and people still look at Mountcastle as someone that's going to be safe for multiple years, you might get a nice return via trade now that you won't be able to get a year or two from now.
Yeah. But, then I think that, if you don't like Mountcastle, it's okay to wait because I do like the Rizzo-Naylor-Bell grouping. You know, that's a grouping that has ADPs all the way from 150 down to 220 for Naylor. I think your concerns about playing time might sort of begin with Naylor. It's Naylor and Vaughn I have next. Naylor, Vaughn, France. I do think Naylor needs to play. I think he's one of the few people on that team that can hit the ball hard. if you're looking at max exit velos and barrel rates on this team, yes, of course you got Jose Ramirez, but you don't have a lot else. And he had a near 9% barrel rate, a 113 max EV. Paired it with that, Clevelandian strikeout rate. I think Naylor needs to play. Maybe he's going to sit against some lefties, which will cause you some issues and is relevant to what you're talking about in terms of playing time. But I actually think they need to play him most of the time. And I think that it gets a little bit more dicey after that in the sort of Arise, Vargas, Miranda place that I was talking about. Where do you have a guy that you like after that goes after Arise? So Arise is 213 right now, I think. And then I guess Naylor is 220. So do you have a first baseman you like that goes after 225?
I got a couple. I think now that he has a team, Trey Mancini makes a lot of sense in this range. He'll jump up. Players in this range that sign, as soon as they sign, they go up a couple of rounds, but he'll still be affordable enough where I think that's a steady projection. Like him more as a corner than as a weight at first base sort of guy. If we're in a 15-team league and he's my primary first baseman, something probably went wrong. I probably waited too long and I'm giving up some pretty valuable stats to do it. I do like Miguel Vargas a lot. He's first base eligible to begin the season because that's where he played the most in his brief time in the big leagues last year. Can't remember if you said this while we were recording or before we started recording, but Miguel Vargas hits fastballs hard. Like
he's number one.
Yeah, he's got that ability. It's a little bit like the way I felt about Jose Miranda this time last year, where it's like, okay, there's a few different spots he can play. It's a good team. It's a good core set of skills. This is probably going to work. The early weeks of the season could be bumpy, though.
Yeah, the problem with taking Miguel Vargas is I think it means you have to take another first base.
He's going late enough right now where...
He could be your third, or he could be your third corner.
He could be your third, and then you have to do the thing where if he is your corner, you do have to have a bench. You do have to have one more corner-eligible, first-base-eligible player. I would agree with that assessment. So you do have to think about managing the bottom of the roster.
I do like him in a bench capacity. And in fact, I'd rather have Miguel Vargas in a bench capacity than someone like Seth Brown. As much as Seth Brown is going to play, I think Seth Brown showed us, you know, he's 30 years old. You know, he plays in a tough park, and he's a classic sort of, I'm trying to hit homers. That's what he told me. You know, he's like, I'm just trying to hit homers. And so, you know, I see a guy who's going to hit like 220 and have 25 homers. And that's, you know, sort of borderline in most leagues. And it's going to be hard to know when to cut him or not, you know. Whereas I think if you have Miguel Vargas on your bench, you know what you're looking for, playing time. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just looking for playing time. And if he gets the playing time, then it's because he's playing well. And he's going to be better than Seth Brown. So, you know, of course, things flip a little bit. If I'm talking about an AL only, obviously, I don't want Miguel Vargas. but also just in the deepest leagues, in AL onlys, I start to like people that I think will just play most of all. So in an AL only or in an only league, I don't know. Miguel Vargas becomes a possibility of being an overpriced prospect type where I'm not sure about the playing time and I have to play him. What if he gets 300 plate appearances this year? Then that'll be a rough go of me plugging him in every week, you know? So in an only league, I'd prefer Seth Brown. You know, some of the deeper names that I like in only leagues are Seth Brown, Will Myers, I don't know, Jared Walsh, you know, Brandon Drury, Brandon Belt even. You know, I like those names in AL onlys or in only leagues because I think they'll play.
Yeah, the threshold for playing time in a mono league is low enough where the big side platoon masher, which I think very accurately describes what Brandon Belt is at this stage of his career, that plays just fine in an AL only league. It plays fine in draft and hold. It doesn't play as well in the typical mixed league, even a 15-team mixed league. He's good enough to be on the roster. It's going to be difficult to have him on the roster start to finish all season. We talked about it when he signed. 12-team leagues, he'll be up and down off the roster in fantasy leagues a ton because there are going to be some weeks where Brandon Belt has a perfect schedule. Maybe one of the catchers is dinged up too, so he'll play a little extra that week because of the catcher's role in the DH mix in Toronto. But anyway, I think you're right. Deeper leagues especially, he stands out. The other guy that's in this range, he's first base eligible, and he's also second base eligible, but I really don't know what to do with his playing time, is Jake Cronenworth. Is Jake Cronenworth, because of his defensive versatility, still a everyday guy on an improving Padres team? I mean, plate appearances last two seasons, 643 and 684. So you get a ton of runs and a ton of RBIs playing that much in a lineup that good. Power was solid again last year, 17 homers. Given the league context, not bad.
Should have hit for a better batting average, just given his core skills. You know,
yeah, you shouldn't hit for a 239. Like, that's not his skills, no.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yes, the power was down a little bit, but in terms of making contact, powerful enough, speedy enough, he should have hit for a better batting average. Yeah, I think the Padres have to play him. It's weird that he's somehow, you know, this guy who, you know, was a reliever, I think a decent pitcher in college and even threw some in the minor leagues and was supposed to be a utility guy who's going to play all over. was a major coup for the Padres, and I believe Dave Cameron from Fangraphs was involved in his acquisition. You've got this sort of Jake Cronenworth is going to help us wherever becomes Jake Cronenworth as our first baseman. But if you want to field the best defensive team, he is your first baseman because Nelson Cruz is your DH. Matt Carpenter can play some first base. I guess it's Matt Carpenter and Ha-Seong Kim are the people that threaten Cronenworth's playing time.
Yep.
But they won't do it until Tatis is back. And by the time Tatis is back, maybe if Trent Grisham is still struggling along, maybe Tatis takes over center, right? And then you can play, you know, Carpenter and whoever. Then there's like basically an extra spot that means that Cronenworth will play every day. So I tend to think that because the beginning of the season he's going to play every day, that by the end of the season, he'll still be playing every day. You know, it'll just be like, oh, this guy's hurt. Oh, this guy's hurt. Or, oh, Grisham's not playing well. Tatis is a center fielder. Now we need Cronenworth in the outfield. Or we're going to play Carpenter in a corner outfield or whatever it is. You know, we're going to figure this out. In fact, as I'm saying all these, is there a little bit of a weakness in the Padres depth chart here? Like corner outfield a little bit? Would you want to play Matt Carpenter or Nelson Cruz or Jake Cronenworth in a corner outfield position?
No, I would not.
That's interesting. That's why they picked up Adam Engel recently. But yeah, if Grisham's not good, Engel's not really who you want to be starting. And Tatis could be a center fielder.
Tatis almost has to be a center field, or at least in left. Like he's got to be part of their RL field's a little thin right now, but when he comes back, he's part of that rotation, so it's fine.
I know there's a lot of people in San Diego listening who are tired of Trent Grisham and are ready to move on. And I hear it, I guess. He's been a league average player every year he's played, you know, full time, so I like him, but last year was a little rough with the bat.
Oh yeah. it was pretty brutal last season. I just thought he was interesting to bring up just because I don't know, like I like him a lot as a second baseman. He's fine. He's first and second base eligible, so you can move him around.
And that's nice too. I mean, this is in draft and hold season. You know, that's great. That's CIMI, first base, second base. That's great.
You mentioned Joey Meneses. He's first base and outfield eligible just inside the top 200. Are you trending into a place where you might actually consider taking Meneses there? Or do you just find that there are other players, other positions that make more sense in that 175 to 200 range overall?
No, I like him. I've been finding that, people have been denigrating outfield, and we'll get to this. I think I might end up taking him as an outfielder. That can maybe play backup first or corner infield as opposed to taking him as a first baseman, if that makes sense. I know that people have been saying that outfield gets bad late, but there's tons of Joey Meneses types, you know, that I feel like you can get later that hit 250 with 25 homers, and that's fine. That's great for your, like, fourth outfielder.
Yeah, could be an okay corner guy in a deep enough league as well. Let's get to some young players in darts. We've already named a few. I think Tristan Casas by ADP is one of the more intriguing young players that seems to have a path to a ton of playing time this year for the Red Sox. If things are going to go right in Boston, Tristan Casas being good this year would certainly help push things in those directions. Are you in based on what you've seen from Casas so far in the big leagues and, of course, what we saw in the upper levels of the minor leagues?
He worried me a little bit when he told me that he doesn't really like to study or he's not into like tech or data and he's a feel guy. But hey, it takes all types to make a baseball team go. And not everyone has to be a data guy like I want them to be. Really like his patience combined with the swing strike rate. I think that strikeout rate will come down. He hits too many ground balls right now, but a 110.5 max EV suggests the raw power is there. Doesn't swing at balls outside the zone. The process all seems good. I don't know really why he hit 197 last year, other than maybe he got shifted real hard and just ground balled everything into the shift, which you know, that's changing too. So, I'm into him. I like him as a late pick. Like right now, is there anybody going to take his playing time?
I don't think Bobby Dalbec's going to do it.
I mean, the contact rate is just so bad.
And they've got enough holes elsewhere. They can't really afford to take their versatile guys that might need to fill in somewhere up the middle and play them at first base either. So I think he gets a pretty good opportunity to begin the season to prove that he is ready to take this job and run with it.
I do too. And, you know, there's guys around him that just have a lot more question. I like Lamont Wade Jr. As a veteran 29-year-old that has done a lot of things right, has a good K rate, has had good barrel rates. But if things don't go well for Wade, he's on a team that will marginalize him quickly.
The Spencer Torkelson experience was not a fun one a year ago. There were some encouraging signs underneath. There was the good O-swing percentage. Again, we're looking for silver linings last year. Not really a lot of threats to take his job. Clearly someone that the Tigers believe in long-term as someone who went 1-1 in the 2020 draft. So what do you think year two might look like for Spencer Torkelson? And do you think around pick 300, this is actually a good late dart that you could throw as your first baseman off the bench, perhaps, or your corner infielder off the bench? Do you think there's enough here to take that chance?
Yeah, I guess so. But I like Casas's process numbers better. You know, Casas didn't swing and miss so often. You know, the max EV was there for Torkelson, so the raw power is there. Casas also is willing to pull the ball, where Torkelson's done a lot of opposite field work. Now, didn't Detroit change their outfield as well? So that might help Torkelson a little bit. Yeah, I'm into him. You know, a very different player that's down here that intrigues me. I just did a piece about the Reds and the 80th percentile outcomes. And in that, Spencer Steer had a possibility of being a three war hitter and being the best. He had the best 80th percentile projection on the Reds. and you know, what I see from him is not the greatest batted ball power, but good plate discipline, better strikeout rates in the minors, a really nice swinging strike rate, really just gobs of opportunity. And I don't think, you know, I think Torkelson, if he struggles, could get sent down. Whereas I think Steer might get a whole season to struggle in Cincinnati, and a bunch of rope. And again, we have the steamer bat difference in opinion when it comes to a rookie. But Steamer's projection of 240 and 19 homers from Steer is just something that I can kind of almost believe in, because he's just going to play, and it's a good bark to play in. So I put Steer as just a notch below Isak Paredes as, you know, these utility guys that I'm actually pretty excited about.
Yeah, there's a few other guys that have multi-position eligibility, a couple older guys, DJ LeMahieu and Wilmer Flores, that go pretty late. I mean, I don't think of them as first baseman for my fantasy team, but they can fill in that spot. They both are in lineups that should produce. Both can be moved around between first, second, and third. I think where they're going, I have no problem using them as glue guys. And I think they work really well if you're going to take a chance on a young first base only player, because you're going to need some versatility on the bench if you're going to have that extra guy that's not necessarily offering you something those first couple weeks of the season.
Like if you're in a draft and hold, you know, if you have three major league first basemen that you think will play, then you're fine. You know, mm-hmm. I'd like to try to have three. But if one of that three is Tristan Casas, then you may want to have another eligibility somewhere. So you have four eligibilities and three human beings,
right?
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like to have four eligibilities at every position, but you have to be careful because sometimes with your multiple eligibility, especially on the middle infield, I've gotten to places where I had four eligibilities at second and short, and I had four guys, you know, four eligibilities each at second and short. And I only had four guys. it was that sort of deal. So you have to be careful to actually have human beings, you know, as well. So that's weird when you say it that way.
Count the players correctly.
Yeah, exactly. I'm one last note for me about first base is just how quickly Jared Walsh fell from grace. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I have a reason to say no, the projections are wrong. One thing that the projections are right on is maybe sub 500 plate appearances, because he does seem to be a platoon player at this point, and the team even seems to have built a platoon partner for him in Brandon Drury. So if you're going to tap out at 500 plate appearances, then you're already capping your upside value. And he always had a bit of an issue with strikeout rate. It's gotten worse. And even the barrel rate got worse. But even if he get the barrel rate back, I don't know if he's going to hit much better than 230 or 240. So now you got a 240 guy with maybe 30 homer upside who's only going to play 500 plate appearances. So he's going to hit like 240 with 22 homers or something, Jared Walsh. So, you know, what? Maybe in a deep league, if he's like, you know, a $2-3 guy, then I'm into it, like in an only league. But is he going to be on your NFBC rosters, even draft and holds? I mean,
draft and holds, what are you hoping yes. for?
Like as a third first baseman, a draft and hold where you just plug him in to get some plate appearances when the other two guys are hurt or whatever.
Yeah, I think if you're in a situation where Brandon Belt is in play, Jared Walsh is in play right around that same window, and you got to make a decision. Which one do you like better? I think I actually like Belt better. Like, I believe more in the longer track record from Belt in that particular instance. But I think that's the situation for me.
I can tell a story where Jared Walsh ends up playing every day a little bit more than Brandon Belt. The story that I would tell is that this team doesn't have a shortstop. Somebody that they thought would be a depth piece is their everyday shortstop. Fletcher, Renjifo, Urshela. One of those guys ends up being their everyday shortstop because they needed it. You know? And if that happens, then maybe Brandon Drury becomes their everyday second baseman. And if that happens, then they're a little bit more likely to need an everyday first baseman. I don't know, though. It's actually pretty crowded there all of a sudden. Maybe. No, I'll take Walsh just barely over Belt. Younger, knees are in better shape, I hope.
Yeah, I wonder if the playing surface in Toronto is more of a problem for Brandon Belt than I'm giving it credit for. But I do think you have to look at Jared Walsh's 2022 and consider the possibility that he was playing through that injury for a significant share of it, because mm-hmm. the power outage doesn't really make any sense.
But you don't have much to look at in terms of thoracic outlet and hitters.
Yeah, it's an unusual problem, and it's the kind of thing that does seem to be a longer road to recovery for, too. So I think maybe that's part of my skepticism, too. But if he's healthy this spring, that sort of changes the outlook. And you know, by the time people get to the actual drafts, we might have information that starts to move Jared Walsh up. And if he's totally healthy, no limitations, looks really good in the spring, I could get on board with that. We kind of sidestepped Matt Mervis with the young first baseman.
We talked to him a lot when we did the cast about
Mancini going there, yeah.
Signing, but I think we both agree that we like him still, and we still think there's an opportunity for him. It's an awkward, he could be a draft pick that you pick for $2 in an NL only, and then you put him on your bench, and you go, you know, and you go to FAB to find a utility guy, or you use a guy that you've got in reserve. You know, I do that sometimes where I pay a little bit to get a prospect that I know I can demote, and then I can bring up somebody I got in reserves that I think will play. Especially because you're talking about utility, but it's a little bit of an awkward pick in, like, I don't think NFBC regular formats is a good pick because he's not going to play to begin. Then you're going to nurse this guy along on your bench. I don't think so. And then draft and holds, he's an interesting, like, I think I'd rather have Casas because he's going to play. But if I had three major league first basemen, like if Walsh was my third first baseman, and I had a spot for a prospect, maybe take Mervis as my prospect late in the game, and then I have a prospect that plays at a position I might need help in.
Yeah, so I think the takeaway on Mervis would be that if you're in a league where you can afford the bench spot, you may have to take him earlier than the cover you're going to get later, Walsh and Belt, and even like Carlos Santana, if you think he's going to play. I mean, do you think any one of Carlos Santana or Joey Votto or Dominic Smith or Luke Voigt, guys that we used to rely on at this position, do you think any of those guys end up being reliable enough to be fantastic late values for either the mono leagues or for draft and holds, or even as maybe in-season pickups in leagues where you end up chasing first base early in the season?
I think Dominic Smith would have to recover his old barrel rate before I believed in him. And that barrel rate that he had that was so good was in 199 plate appearances in 2020 of all seasons. Otherwise, he's had a pretty mediocre barrel rate, mediocre max EV, mediocre chase rate for the most part. Too many ground balls, not a real great strike. I mean, I'm not trying to be mean. I just don't have a place where I'm like, oh, at least he does this, you know? I would take Mervis over a lot of those guys.
Yeah, I think they're depth behind them. Last thing,
we don't talk about this enough. In dynasty leagues, first year player draft, Mervis is going to be a decent pick.
Right, because he wasn't previously stashed in a lot of those leagues.
Yeah, sometimes you don't have an ability to pick up minor leaguers during the season. Mervis is one of those guys that popped, you know, and he may be a better pick than somebody who went in the first round of the college draft or the draft, you know, because a lot of those guys, if you think about it, the first five picks in the draft are way better than the rest of the draft. So if you're talking about, do I want to pick the 10th best guy who went in the first round of last year's draft, or do I want to take Matt Mervis? I'm taking Matt Mervis.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Proximity to the big leagues, things he's shown at the upper levels of the minor leagues, that all checks out for sure. One prospect before we go, Kyle Manzardo, I think is really interesting in Tampa Bay. I think you could see some statistical similarities to Vinny Pasquantino, where you have this first baseman making his way through the minor leagues with really good eye at the plate. Nice low strikeout rate, getting to that power consistently. 22 homers combined over 93 games a year ago. Finished the year at Double A. Not old for the level. I mean, he's a college draftee in 2021 as a second rounder.
But doing everything he's supposed to do at every level.
Yeah, I just wonder how long the Rays are going to make him wait. Like, if he opens the year back at Double A, spends 3 or 4 weeks there, and just continues to mash, I would think they'd give him a look at Triple A. And once he's there, how long does it take before he can earn the call up when you look at Harold Ramirez, Yandy Diaz?
They seem to wait forever, man.
Why though? Like, look at this offense. Look at the
Aranda's
way they're built.
Already 24 years old. I mean, he's been playing it above Double A for 2 years.
I know. I mean, we talked about him, I think, as a prospect of the week. I like Jonathan Aranda. He could play a couple more spots. Manzardo's like really like a true first baseman, I think, by every possible account.
I think it's just time for them. As much as Yandy Diaz does some things that we all like. Isn't it? And Harold Ramirez was a guy they picked up off of waivers. Like, those guys can't be standing in the way of Manzardo if he's got a 150 WRC plus in AAA.
I think it's a second half sort of call up timetable. So again, the types of redraft leagues where you stash a player like this are limited. It's AL only. It's draft and hold very late. But I just look at that group: Ramirez, Diaz plays a lot of third. Isak Paredes is a righty. They've got the DH spot too, so some combination of two guys. If Aranda and Manzardo are both hitting, they could also both be in the lineup at the same time. That's a possibility. I see a lot that could go right for Manzardo. I think if you like Matt Mervis at all, I think you should be very excited about Kyle Manzardo.
Harold Ramirez is hanging on by a string. You know, he was a below average bat in his career before he got to Tampa, and in Tampa he had a .350 batting average on balls in play and was suddenly better than league average. The projections are amazing. They all say he's going to be above league average, even though he's only had 435 plate appearances out of his 1,253 that were above average. What is it they like about him? He makes contact. He has a good max EV. This is a Tampa Bay Rays player. They love guys who hit the ball hard, don't barrel the ball, and don't strike out. It's a very strange thing. They love that player. Do they love that player because they think they can make them barrel the ball?
Maybe.
Or do they think that they love that player because they think the league loves barrels too much?
I think they love that player because that player does not make a lot of money. I think that's That player might get along really well with other players in the clubhouse, and that player might hit the ball hard and have some on-field attributes they like, but I think the thing that they like the most is that the dollars that they pay him are not
much
a lot. That's what I think they really like about him.
I mean, they've clicked up so many guys like this. It's amazing.
Yeah, but I think with Ramirez being a righty, that especially, it's like they kind of need a new left-handed regular option at first base unless they see an everyday guy in that current list. I don't see one. Maybe they do. But that's going to do it for our 2023 first base preview. Of course, many other episodes coming in this series. So if you're new, take a moment, leave us a nice rating and review, and be sure to come back for future episodes. You can drop us questions. RatesandBarrels@theAthletic.com is the email address. You can find Eno on Twitter at EnoSaris. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. If you don't have a subscription to The Athletic, you can get one for just $2 a month for the first year at theAthletic.com/RatesandBarrels.
Thanks for listening.